In this present crisis, government is not the solution to our problem. Government is the problem.
This is the I Spy Radio Show.
You and I have a rendezvous with destiny.
Keeping an eye on big government.
We the people tell the government what to do. It doesn't tell us.
The trouble with our liberal friends is not that they're ignorant. It's just that they know so much that isn't so.
And now, here is your host, Mark Anderson.
The last few weeks we've been focused on equity and fairness, which I am completely for. In fact, there are a few things that tick me off more than inequality or unfairness. As we said, equity and fairness is a new weapon by the political left, which really ticks me off because when the left says equity and fairness, what they really mean is fairness for them and their political cronies. Here's a hint. If it's not fair for everyone, it's not fair. If it's not equal for everyone, it's not equal. Well, it's been a week of ticking me off with stories in the news or not in the news on inequality and unfairness. Except, of course, the media is blind to their own massive hypocrisy. Take, for example, what should have been a massive story this week, but I didn't see so much as a whisper of it in what used to be the media. Joe Biden walked up to a group of reporters before boarding Marine One to take a question, much like Trump used to do. Except it was fake. Did you see this? The White House staff literally faked an impromptu press conference using a green screen footage of Joe and superimposed it over the gaggle of reporters. Except someone blew it. Joe's hand magically phases over the mics. Joe wasn't there. And this footage appeared on Bloomberg News, The Hill, and C-SPAN, but none of them commented on that. Now, why would they do this? Where was the real Joe? Why did the media play along? Talk about fairness and equal treatment. Can you imagine endless days of rage if President Trump had filmed himself off-site and then used green screen footage to fake an impromptu press conference? Another story. Joe's administration is using $4 billion of that $1.9 trillion COVID relief bill to pay off up to 120% of farm loans of blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and Native American farmers, but not whites. This is absolutely racism. Federal policies should be colorblind. You don't solve racism by creating policies that are racist, rewarding some races over others. That's the definition of racism. Now, some media tried to defend this, saying it was an attempt to overcome a history of systemic racism and discrimination. Okay, let's look at that logically. This is a debt relief package paying off loans. If they got the loans, then they weren't discriminated against. For discrimination to be a factor in this, they would have needed to be denied a loan. But no, they got the loan because this is paying off loans they already secured. Think about that. You've worked for decades to pay off the mortgage on your farm, and your neighbor, who just bought his, gets it 100% paid off, plus another 20% to pay off any taxes. You think that approach is going to solve racial tensions? Using racist tactics means you're the racist. Just like using fascist tactics to burn and loot and destroy and intimidate doesn't make you an anti-fascist, using fascist tactics makes you a fascist. On today's show, we'll be talking about the woke left, especially woke corporations that selectively discriminate, like Disney treating a conservative actress very differently than they did a progressive actor. And in the second half, we'll talk about the right to keep and bear arms for everyone, and the assault by the left on those foundational freedoms. I'd like to welcome Scott Shepard to the show. He is a fellow at the National Center for Public Policy and the Deputy Director of the National Center's Free Enterprise Project, launched in 2007. The Free Enterprise Project focuses on shareholder activism and the confluence of big government and big business. Scott, it's great to talk to you.
Great to talk to you.
You know, I see here that you're also an attorney and you have taught law both at Wake Forest and right here in Oregon at Willamette University, which is actually my alma mater for my MBA. What brought you to Oregon?
Oh, well, I had the good fortune in law school of having a dear friend who was from Springfield originally and who moved to Portland after law school. And so I got out there and got to see some of it and just fell in love and had the opportunity to spend a few years out there working on the things we'll be talking about today, and also teaching property and trust and estates at Willamette Law School. And just it's just the best place in the world if you exclude the politics in Portland.
Yeah, if only we could get rid of that, it really would be the best place on earth. So recently, talk to our audience about the Free Enterprise Project and remind us what you do and specifically how you engage with corporations at shareholder meetings.
Yeah. So our, among other things, what our project does is to attend. We own some stock through the organization, and we attend on the basis of that stock ownership. We attend shareholder meetings and put questions to the CEOs of these companies that that put them on the spot about dumb things that they're up to or increasingly discriminatory things that they're up to try to get information for the shareholders about how that shareholder money is really being spent. And we also submit shareholder proposals to these companies that ask them to, for instance, not discriminate on the basis of viewpoint or political participation. More and more companies, especially the particularly woke ones, are just firing people. Disney did it just recently with the Mandalorian stars.
Yes.
Firing people who have the temerity to express a non-woke view. And so we fight that in every way that we can.
Yeah, as you mentioned, you guys recently had a bit of a confrontation there with Disney's CEO, and we'll talk about that in a little bit. But before we get into that, when you attend shareholder meetings, how much are you really able to engage with the corporate leadership? I mean, is it just one and done questions to which they give sound bites, or are you able to have an actual meaningful discussion?
Well, during these virtual meetings, it's even tougher because we can do them from home. We don't have to travel. But on the other hand, they set it up so that you have to type in the question in advance. And then they just ignore all the hard-hitting questions and instead ask the question, "We love you so much. Can you tell us how you're going to be even better next year?" sort of thing, and then run out the clock. So that's been frustrating. But even New York is recognizing that it's time to open up the world. Soon it'll only be California and North Korea that are left closed. And so as that happens, we'll be able to go to meetings in person again. And when we can do that, we can at least get one question in as of right by shareholders. But what we'd like to see is, and if any of your listeners have any interest in this at all, what we'd like to see is engaged shareholders coming to meetings that are close to them or that they have a particular interest in and help us out by asking follow-up questions, asking questions of their own, demonstrating to these companies that it's not just the left who's paying attention and not just the left who demands anymore that their political interests and their personal interests and their livelihood and their interest in not being canceled are taken seriously. And so that's a new enterprise. We're branching out to try to get more members of the public involved.
Good,
to support
good.
Us.
Yeah. So in terms of that confrontation there with Disney's CEO, you guys wanted to know why the Mandalorian co-stars Gina Carano and Pedro Pascal received vastly different treatment for some similar social media posts. What was his response when you confronted him on that?
Oh, it was astonishing. He said, because our question was, how do you explain this discrimination? You're discriminating against those of us on the right. And Bob Chapek, the new CEO there, said, "Oh, well, we don't think that we lean right or lean left. We just stand for universal values, for the values that will cause us all to live in peace and harmony in the world." It was that nauseating.
Wow.
But even more astonishing was that if you take that apart, he can't mean that we have a peaceful and harmonious world if nobody compares current events to the Nazis, because Pascal still works there. So what he has to mean is that we can only live in a world that recognizes the universal values and that has peace and harmony if it's perfectly okay to shut down all discussion by eliminating, canceling, destroying those of us on the right.
Yeah.
That's insane. And it's the sort of thing that everybody who has anything to do with Disney ought to know about and be responsive to.
Yeah, absolutely. So Disney has certainly taken a hard turn to the left. You know, don't talk to me about socially responsible and your woke corporation if you use overseas labor to make your products. You know, until you fix that, you just really need to shut up about this. And I'm looking at you, Nike and Apple. Anyway, coming up, more on corporate wokeness with Scott Shepard of the Free Enterprise Project. And welcome back. We're talking today about American corporations taking a sharp turn to the left and social issues. We're doing that with Scott Shepard, the Deputy Director of the Free Enterprise Project, which is a program of the National Center for Public Policy Research. You can find out more about them by heading to nationalcenter.org. You know, my kids used to just love going into the Disney store, and I used to love taking them there because things like Peter Pan and the Sword in the Stone and all of that, they were part of my childhood too. And now looking at what Disney has been doing, I'm not even sure I want them involved with Disney at all. Of course, I guess I should say future grandkids. But, because of that wokeness, Disney used to be a wholesome, family-oriented company. What happened to them as a company? How did they lurch so quickly to the left?
Well, I think that there are just real committed leftists at the top of that organization now. I think that Bob Iger and Bob Chapek really are of the left and don't mind putting their finger on the scales on behalf of the left and discriminating just as hard as they can get away with legally and without paying attention, but also because we on the right have lives. We've got families to raise. We have jobs and we care about our jobs. We care about taking care of our family and not asking the government to take care of our family. So we aren't as involved in what euphemistically with a couple of presidents back was called community organizing. We're not so interested in campaigning and rioting and protesting and shouting and demanding the way everybody on the left seems constantly to do. But the problem with that is that we've fallen far behind in letting corporations know that we're paying attention as well, and that we'll respond as hard as the left does when we're discriminated against, as we're being discriminated against, and that we're going to protest and we're going to show up and we're going to make this all clear, and we're not going to let go until they start treating us with respect as well. And so what's required, for instance, when we make these shareholder proposals, we're just about the only organization on the right that's doing this. And we manage about 25 a year, and we fight the good fight, but the other side is putting in 20 times that many. And they've got a coalition of 20 or 30 people in organizations with a lot of money to make the effort, and they get groups to show up at shareholder meetings and protest about the craziest things, as you can imagine.
Yes.
And on our side, nothing. So even at corporations that aren't as hard left and discriminatory as Disney, they still get the feedback that it's the left that's paying attention and is all wound up, and that we'll just go along with anything. And so they behave in sort of a rational business way. They behave accordingly. So part of what we need to do is really to get in there and start being the irritating, demanding.
Yes, the old squeaky wheel.
That's right. That's right. Our wheel has to squeak if we're gonna stop the movement left.
Well, it's really amazing how things have changed. Milton Friedman was a Nobel Prize winner for economics, and one of the chief intellectuals behind Reaganomics and the economic revival of the 1980s. Friedman, in a 1973 article, said that a corporation's social responsibility is to provide a profit to the shareholders, who are the real owners of the company, and provide good wages and treat their employees fairly. That's it. That was his idea of corporate social responsibility. Further, Milton said that if a CEO diverted corporate funds for what they deemed philanthropic aims, he said they were essentially the unwitting puppets of the intellectual forces that have been undermining the basis of a free society these past decades. They had even turned themselves into, quote, unelected government officials who were illegally taxing employers and customers. In other words, the CEOs were basically stealing or at least misappropriating profits from the owners for their own personal beliefs. I mean, how have we gone from that view of corporate social responsibility, profits to the investors and good jobs for employees, to what we have today?
Well, there's been a great push, especially in the academy for decades, but dumb ideas flow out of the academy like water in Oregon. But, it's gotten into the mainstream, the idea of stakeholder capitalism, which is to say that corporations shouldn't just be run for the benefit of their shareholders, which is to say the owners, but should be run for the benefit of, and I put this in scare quotes, all stakeholders. But the problem with that is that you can't do anything for the benefit of everybody, because people have different opinions about what they want done, right? There are some stakeholders that want X and some that want Y. because stakeholders eventually means everybody. And so what ends up happening is that, well, and what's happened recently is that the woke CEOs have jumped all on board with stakeholder capitalism, because if you get to pretend to do something on behalf of all stakeholders, but there isn't anything that all stakeholders approve of, then you can do whatever you want, say that it's for the benefit of all stakeholders, and in fact threaten, as a lot of these companies, and Disney, for example, threaten your employees to let them know that if they share opinions that are different than the CEO's, they might lose their job, right? So of course the only opinions that they'll hear, that the CEOs will hear from employee stakeholders, are the ones that the CEOs already hold, because everybody else is afraid to lose their jobs. Right. So what happens is, instead of having to be responsible to shareholders, these CEOs can now run independent, unelected policy shops to try to control the rest of us under the name of stakeholder capitalism.
Right, right. So do you think corporations should just get out of corporate social responsibility entirely?
Well, I think that corporate social responsibility is one of those flag terms that we on the right should avoid, because shareholder capitalism is corporate responsibility of the only sensible kind. Because if you are caring about the long-term success of your company and the long-term value of the shareholders, of the owner's property, then you're necessarily going to make decisions that are in the best interests of employees and of customers and of all other relevant stakeholders, because you're not going to pay employees too little so that they go do other jobs, but you're not going to pay them too much so that you're robbing from the owners, from the shareholders. And the same way with clients. You're not going to offend clients, but you're not going to pander in offensive ways to certain narrow and discrete groups of clients at the cost of other clients. So shareholder primacy, shareholder capitalism, is actually in the best interest, the best coherent interest of all members of the community and society, whereas stakeholder capitalism is just a ruse.
Yeah, oh, and I agree. And if you feel the need to be donating hundreds of millions of dollars, maybe you ought to think about donating that to your employees, I think. All right, let's go take a break there. We'll wrap things up with Scott Shepard after this. And welcome back. We're talking today about the sudden insatiable desire by formerly sane companies to embrace leftist ideology. And we're doing that with Scott Shepard. He's the Deputy Director of the Free Enterprise Project. You can find out more about that by heading to nationalcenter.org and look at the programs tab up at the top. Scott, do you guys there at the Free Enterprise Project have any idea or guesses how much corporate funding is leached off of corporations to find its ways to promote left-leaning organizations?
Well, we know that it's been billions and billions of dollars just in 2020. Lots of either real or pretend, scare quotes, social justice or racial justice donations. And of course, those terms illustrate the problem, right? Because if something's given for social justice or social equity, what do those terms mean? What they often mean is that woke, when the CEOs are actually woke, that it's a shakedown and a of taking shareholder assets, the owners of the company's assets, and handing them over to these astonishing left-wing organizations, some of which are actively stirring up the rioting in aid of things that are called anti-racism, but are incredibly racist. I mean, you look at the white fragility, white supremacy doctrine that's leaked out of the universities, and it's grim and it's racist, and it makes certain races responsible for generational guilt and make certain races inherently inferior because they're bad and they're all bad in certain ways that no other races can be bad. And so a lot of it is just funding racism.
Yeah, which itself is a very racist view. If you're painting all whites as somehow being white supremacists, well, guess what? That's a racist view. So it's crazy. You know, I mentioned in my opener there about the racism of the Biden administration in terms of what they're doing with these farmers. But anyway, you know, you're talking about really mingling a lot of corporate social responsibility with politics. And Whatever happened to Citizens United? Because I thought the left wanted corporations to stay out of politics.
Well, I mean, that's when they didn't have the upper hand. With the left, they stick by a principle until the minute it doesn't serve them anymore, and then they abandon that principle. And sometimes that happens on the right as well. But from my point of view, what I'm looking for, what I seek is a free if possible society where our constitutional liberties are protected. So I'm stuck with my values, and I defend those and nothing else. And I think a lot of us on the right do, but that doesn't seem to be true on the left. Consider that now they're trying to cancel anybody who disagrees with them.
Oh, absolutely.
When we were growing up, we heard about the McCarthy hearings and that it was the right that tried to cancel people for political disagreement. So, you know.
Well, except the difference is, of course, is that there really were communists working in Hollywood. Just read the book,
yeah,
Disinformation.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, it's crazy. So companies that used to be very proud to be American companies have been steadily moving production to other countries, taking jobs from Americans. Trump had stopped that in large part, and many started coming back to the U.S., but now Biden has reversed that yet again. In fact, the United Auto Workers Union recently accused Ford of shifting new vehicle production from an Ohio plant to one in Mexico. If it's social responsibility these American companies are pushing, doesn't that start with keeping American workers employed?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, when it boils down to it, one of the most disruptive and destructive facets of American life is the union. It's just a collusion against the people when it's public unions, but private unions. I grew up in, you know, Appalachia goes all the way up into Pennsylvania. I grew up in the Appalachian part of Pennsylvania. And company after company, when I was a boy, were driven out by these unions that demanded higher and higher prices. And the company said, no, we're just going to go to Georgia or wherever. And now it's Mexico. And they're trying to make it impossible for southern or western states to have competitive wages with national unionization now. But all that's going to do is force absolutely everything abroad. We won't be able to make a shoestring in the United States anymore, because we'll be priced out of everything. And and that's, you know, the Biden economic policy errors are almost infinite, and it's only been 70 days.
Yeah, I know. It's been scary how quickly this has moved. You know, as I said, recently the Biden administration announced it was using $4 billion of the COVID relief package to pay off farm loans to blacks, Hispanics, Asians, and other minorities, up to 120% of their loans. But only to minorities, which is absolutely racist, in my opinion. And I've had that story playing in my mind all week, especially as I was prepping for the show. And I was reading through the introduction to one of your law papers, The Unbearable Cost of Skipping the Check, which had to do with property rights and compensation. And this line of yours from that introduction, talking about water rights, which, of course, is a huge thing here in Oregon and throughout the West, it really struck me. You said this, quote, "The federal government repeatedly and consistently acceded to the new water regime in these states. As the U.S. Supreme Court has recognized, that accession has long since become obligatory and irrevocable." And I think about that in the context of what's happening in society today and this rush to embrace what is fundamentally Marxist ideology rather than preserve American ideology. Whether you're talking about the corporate wokeness or things like new systemic racism of the Biden government, where it's okay to reward minorities while punishing whites. I mean, are we in danger of courts institutionalizing this so that we can never shake the Marxist dust off our boots?
Well, I think we might be, but I think that if that happens, and I don't want to be cataclysmic or apocalyptic or anything, but I think if we're that far down the road, then we're going to have real, pretty much open warfare in the not too distant future. Because if the majority in this country is going to be treated with the hatred and the disdain and the as inferiors, the way that blacks were treated in the South 80 years ago, then they're going to fight back. And that's we're reintroducing step by step all of the things that we've all spent 60 years trying to get rid of. And we're doing it in the name of anti-racism. And it's one of the most appalling and Orwellian scenarios that you could write. It would be terrible fiction, but here we are.
Yeah. You know, it's amazing. Rather than learning from that experience of that institutionalized racism, they've instead turned that into a weapon. It's rather shocking. Scott, I want to thank you so much for your time. This has been really fascinating.
Oh, thank you so much for having me, Mark. I'd love to talk to you again.
Oh, absolutely. And welcome back. Thanks for joining us today here on the iSpy Radio Show, where every week we get you a little more intelligence on big government. We're joined now by Cody Wisniewski with the Mountain States Legal Foundation. He is the director of the Center to Keep and Bear Arms. Cody, it's great to have you on.
Mark, thank you so much for having me. Happy to be here.
Yeah, my mouth seems to have suddenly stopped working, but we'll just steady on there. So defending our freedoms is definitely an everyday fight, and perhaps nowhere more so than defending the Second Amendment. Let our audience know a bit more about your organization and about the newly formed Center to Keep and Bear Arms and why it got started.
Absolutely. So Mountain States Legal Foundation has been around since 1977, so we're definitely not a new organization. We've been based in the West, and we've litigated right to own, right to use, property rights cases since our founding. And, you know, that's been a very important aspect of our work, but we've also done Second Amendment work during that time. One of our earliest cases dealt with an individual who was charged by the federal government for defending himself against a grizzly bear. Mm. And because the grizzly bear was a protected species, he was charged with what's called a take under the Endangered Species Act for killing that grizzly bear. But he only killed the grizzly bear because the grizzly bear was charging him at his home. So that was one of our first cases that we dealt with the right self-defense, right? And I mean, that case took years and what would have been millions of dollars in legal fees for us to defend that individual. But because Mountain States is what we are and the way we are, we actually don't charge our clients any attorney's fees for our representation. All of our legal representation is pro bono.
Hmm. You said that you got started 50 years ago. How have gun laws changed over the years? I mean, and were gun rights a big concern back then?
It was a little different in the 70s, obviously. there wasn't as much of a threat to our Second Amendment protected rights as there is today, which is exactly what prompted us to launch this new project and to launch the Center to Keep and Bear Arms. And the center was designed specifically to focus on consistent, targeted litigation. So a lot of organizations do a lot of good work lobbying and doing those sorts of things, but we don't do any of that. We do straightforward litigation in courtrooms, and we're the only organization of our kind that does that. We are in-house only, meaning we litigate our own cases in-house, and we just stick to litigation, meaning anything that we do is public information. It's a filing in a courtroom, or it's a press release, or it's a radio conversation with you. So we are nothing behind closed doors.
Good. So what would you say is one of your organization's most important litigations in preserving the Second Amendment? Do you have any really super big wins?
We've had a couple large cases even recently. So we're currently litigating against a city in Colorado that attempted to ban so-called assault weapons and large capacity magazines. That litigation is ongoing, and there was actually a big development in a sister case that we're not litigating that's going to change the way that that one looks. During the COVID lockdowns, we litigated a case in New Mexico where the governor didn't deem gun retailers, ranges, or training facilities to be essential. So we filed a lawsuit against the governor, and rather quickly, firearm retailers and ranges were reopened. So we've had a few large cases. We're currently litigating two cases, one's in New York and one's in California, dealing with the definition of a firearm under the Gun Control Act and whether or not individuals can buy things, that we call 80% lowers or 80% frames, but are really just pieces of plastic or pieces of metal that haven't yet reached the stage to be a firearm.
Hmm. So a decade ago, like a lot of Americans, I used to think, oh, Democrats really don't mean it when they say blank. You know, it's just rhetoric and spin and hyperbole. And, now it's pretty clear that when Democrats say they want to take away guns, they mean it. As an organization, do you get that from people? Oh, Democrats really don't mean it. They're not really going to ban guns.
Yeah. And, I think I agree with you wholeheartedly. I mean, years ago, I was much the same way. And I basically had that same kind of interpretation of, they say they're doing this, but it's really just talk. But, what we're seeing right now is that's not the case anymore. This isn't just talk anymore.
No.
They're taking active steps to, ban some of the most commonly owned firearms in the United States, to make it much more difficult for individuals to access firearms, to make it way more expensive for people to be able to carry their firearms. So these are all things that are going to go into increasing the liability of being a gun owner. And as soon as you increase the liability and you increase the financial barrier to entry, it makes it a lot more difficult for people to exercise their rights.
Yeah, absolutely. So are you seeing some light bulbs come on in regular everyday Democrats and liberals that are starting to see that this party of theirs isn't what they thought it was? Because the Second Amendment isn't just important to conservative Republicans, is it?
Not at all. Well, yes to your first question and not at all to your second. I'm seeing a lot of people, even just people that aren't politically inclined, not necessarily just certain party members, but are really starting to see this shift and this change of, okay, maybe I care a lot more about the ability to own a firearm for self-defense. I think between the pandemic and between riots, yeah, and a lot of things that have gone on over the past year, a lot more people feel unsafe or feel like they might need to take their safety into their own hands. I have a million anecdotal stories of even friends who've reached out and asked me over the past few months of, hey, how do I go and buy a firearm? And these are people that 5 years ago would have voted for every gun control measure that they could get their hands on. Mm. And now they're asking me the legal process on how to get a gun. Yeah. So I think there is a really big shift. And I think you're seeing that shift not only amongst, progressive individuals, but I also think you're seeing this shift a lot more with individuals that live in cities, inner yes. cities. You know, you're seeing more and more minorities exercising their right to keep and bear arms, which is going to be very important for the movement going forward.
Oh, absolutely. I think here in Portland, it was all fine and dandy when the riots were downtown, but when they started marching into neighborhoods, that's, I think, really got the attention of a lot of people. Okay, let's go and take a break there. Coming up, we'll talk about some of those anti-gun laws that are under consideration and some right here in Oregon. Welcome back. We're talking about defending the Second Amendment and the assault on it. We're talking with Cody Wisniewski. He's an attorney and the director of the Center to Keep and Bear Arms, a program of the Mountain States Legal Foundation. You can find out more about them by heading to mslegal.org. That's mslegal.org. And if you missed that, we'll put that up on iSpyRadio.com. And so, Cody, talk to us a bit about what's happening on the federal level in terms of the anti-Second Amendment bills that are being considered right now.
Of course. And so my first disclaimer is, as we discussed before, right, we don't do any lobbying at Mountain States Legal Foundation. So I never advocate for or against the passage of any bill. However, I am more than happy to look at the contents of those bills and talk about some of the constitutional problems, legal problems, as well as just some of the practical considerations. So two of the things that we're seeing move rather quickly through federal legislation is the so-called universal background checks, as well as this removal of, oftentimes it's called kind of like a safety valve on NICS, which is the National Instant Criminal Background Check System. So the first is universal background checks, right? This has been something that parties have been discussing for ages. But what I don't think people realize is that just about every firearm transfer in the United States is already federally controlled. It requires you to undergo a background check. It requires you to go to a licensed federal firearms dealer to conduct the background check as well as transfer you that firearm. And that has to occur in person. The few exceptions to those transfers are private sales. And a lot of these are things like your dad handing down the family shotgun to you, or, you know, a mom bringing her daughter to learn how to shoot and then giving her a gun that she's owned so that when she goes off to college or lives in an apartment on her own, that she's able to defend herself. So what these universal background checks really mean is what's going to happen under federal law would be handing down a family shotgun from father to son would mean that you would need to go to a licensed federal firearms dealer, undergo a federal background check, and have that firearm legally transferred to the son from the father. And so basically, it would require you in every instance to ask the federal government's permission to change ownership of firearms.
Hmm. So in running for office, Biden had said that he wanted to open up the suing of gun manufacturers, which is rather ironic because right now we have experimental vaccines out there and you can't sue those companies if you get a bad reaction or die. What's the legal ramifications of this? Can you, I mean, you can't, as far as I know, sue a car company if somebody uses that car to run you over. So what's the legal prospects of suing gun manufacturers?
Yeah, so there's a current federal law in place that kind of removes the ability for individuals to sue firearm manufacturers. And that's what the current administration has been talking about repealing or revoking or overriding. And you're exactly right. This is a firearm manufacturer cannot be held or should not be able to be held liable for the activities of what people do with their products, right? I mean, you wouldn't hold a car manufacturer liable for somebody that tries to run over individuals. You wouldn't hold a kitchen knife manufacturer liable for somebody that tries to harm another individual with a butcher's knife. These are all well understood principles, not only in our society, but also in our courtrooms. I mean, sure. If there's an intervening person that gets to decide to do something or not to do something, then it's very difficult and realistically nearly impossible to hold that manufacturer or that producer liable, unless they've done something specifically wrong to injure the person.
Hmm. So here in Oregon, there is a list of anti-gun bills, and we'll make sure that we put this list up on icewyradio.com. This is the kind of the short list right now. SB 554, this would limit possession of firearms in public buildings, even if you have a concealed carry license. HB 3055, it's regarding carrying when traveling. That would now add commercial airlines to that list. HB 3268, it would prohibit possession of weapons inside the Capitol, except for police or military. Penalties for that are 5 years imprisonment, $125,000 fine, or both. HB 2543 prohibits transfer of firearms until the state police qualify the recipient of said firearm. The concern here is that the police would be really slow to respond to producing the qualifying reports. In fact, Oregon Firearms Federation says this could allow the Oregon State Police to deny a firearms transfer basically forever with no explanation or justification. And then this one, I'd really like to get your comments on. HB 2510 would give the Oregon Health Authority oversight regarding safe storage of firearms, punishable by fines up to $2,000. Yes, you heard that right. A health agency thinks they should be able to tell you how to store guns in your own home and fine you if you don't do it their way. Could you comment on that last one?
Yeah. So anytime you get into safe storage laws, you're dealing with two the very distinct problems, right? So the first is you're talking about how are individuals able to defend themselves in their homes? So if you've got something that requires you to completely disable the functionality of a firearm or make it to where you can't access it in a high stress situation, you're effectively removing people's rights to defend themselves in the home.
Sure.
If it needs to be locked away and right, I mean, if somebody breaks into your house and it's the middle of the night, it's not like you are able to stop what you're doing, pull out a key, open up your safe, pull out your firearm, load it, chamber around, and then go and figure out what's going on.
Right.
These are high stress scenarios. These are immediate response time scenarios. So these are a lot of the safe storage laws, when you look at their text, are pragmatically very dangerous just from that aspect. Now, the interesting thing with Oregon's, and I say interesting with a very strong asterisk, is exactly what you're mentioning, this idea that the health authority is going to have the authority to decide the appropriate storage, which I'm going to venture out on a limb and guess that they're not experts in firearms. So you're going to have a non-expert agency, not that there's all that many actual expert agencies in existence these days, but they're going to be the ones that are deciding on storage issues with a hefty price tag if you violate that. So yeah. The idea that this is kind of being outsourced into the health authority is could potentially be problematic from a practical consideration, sure. But also is further kind of contributing to this conversation of guns as a health crisis. And, yes, and that's something yeah. that, right, been a tagline for a long time.
And they've already opened that door here in Oregon with red flag laws. Plus, how would they know? I mean, is it going to be opening the door to search and seizure? I mean, and there's a lot of questions here about this bill for sure. Let's go and take a break. The assault on the Second Amendment is never ending unless you're a government official. Then you get all the guns and protections you want. We'll wrap things up with Cody Wisniewski, director of the Center to Keep and Bear Arms. Stay with us. And welcome back. We're in our final segment now with Cody Wisniewski. He's an attorney and the director of the Center to Keep and Bear Arms. That's a program of the Mountain States Legal Foundation. Find out more about them by heading to mslegal.org. That's mslegal.org. And we've been talking about defending the Second Amendment. And, you know, there's always these assaults on guns and defending yourself. But then in the opposite direction of anti-gun bills, Tennessee's Senate passed SB 765. This would allow for the carry of a handgun without a permit. It passed with an overwhelming 23-9 vote in the Tennessee Senate, which sounds really great, but that means three Republicans voted against it. Yes, there are only six Democrats in the Tennessee Senate. Boy, good for them. Anyway, I didn't know this, but apparently no permit required is already law in over a dozen states. Tennessee's governor has supported removing the permitting and training process for getting a gun. Still has to go through the House, but Republicans enjoy a very comfortable lead there, 73-26, before it could even get to the governor. Do you see this bill getting voted into law? It sure sounds like it might.
Yeah, I'm not sure on the Tennessee one in particular. However, I mean, you're right. This has been a movement that really has gained a lot of traction over the past 5 to 10 years. And carriage in general, just carrying firearms, has become despite what you would see from California and New York, has become easier and easier in a lot of states over the past 15 years. But constitutional carry or statutory carry in this sense is a really large movement that's been taking over a lot of states and is really important, right? I mean, the right to defend yourself does not end at your driveway. And that states are recognizing that is really important. And there's a ton of data that shows law-abiding individuals carrying firearms make cities and states safer, not yeah. more dangerous.
Yeah, absolutely. And how many times have you not seen in the news these times that an armed citizen is able to stop an active shooting event? It happens very frequently, and thank God they're there.
Absolutely. And which of these criminals that are engaging in these horrific events, bringing firearms and engaging in, public shootings, how many of them are following the state concealed carry laws that are in existence, right? I mean, it's not like these people, when they're planning their, like I said, horrific events, are going into the police station and applying for a concealed carry permit so that they can have a firearm on them. Yeah. This bar is only a bar to entry for law-abiding citizens, and it is going to affect people because of the cost associated as well. These high costs associated with carriage permits is really deterring.
Yeah, unfortunately, those heroes with guns that stop other people, the bad guys with the guns, unfortunately, just really does not get reported very well. And, it's a known fact, criminals don't obey laws. I mean, why do you think that they would follow gun laws? It's pretty crazy. So what happens, though, if the feds decide to have a national registry while states are out there attempting to relax those very types of requirements? Are states able to override these federal laws?
Oh, that is a really dense topic to introduce in our third segment. basically, there are some open questions between these doctrines, kind of called nullification, as well as kind of the carrot and stick. Most likely what I would see the federal government doing would be tying federal funds to states' willingness to enact certain gun control measures. And the easy answer there is if a state doesn't want to do it, they should say no to the federal funding. But obviously you can hear the where the asterisk in there comes in for a lot of state legislatures.
Well, how would that work? Are you talking about tying funds for, like, say, roads and bridge projects? Somehow that gets tied to some of these gun bills?
Well, and so what the federal government would likely do in that instance would be to tie it to some of the public safety funding, some of the police officer funding, in future federal funding bills. This is something that we saw under the Trump administration with some of the sanctuary cities that was litigated, dealing with tying certain federal funding to enacting certain policies within the state.
I see. So out there on the national scene, in terms of the states, are there other good bills out there that reinforce the Second Amendment?
You know, there's been a lot of movement kind of directly contrary to, I guess, what you're seeing in Oregon in a lot of other states. So there's been a lot of the carriage bills removing the permit requirements that are, like I said, they improve access to firearms and they make communities safer. There's also been some adjustments dealing with storage laws in certain states. So, you know, making it easier for people to actually access their firearms is really important. But, you know, overall, I think you're seeing a lot of the good states get better and a lot of the bad states get worse. So I don't know that trend kind of seems to stay true.
Yeah. We've only got about a minute here with you. Where does the left envision America go? I mean, are we heading into a militarized state like what we see in China and other Marxist countries where only the elected people are allowed to keep and bear arms?
I mean, the progressive dream in this instance would be to disarm the populace and to ensure that only the state is armed. I mean, that's the ultimate goal. I think it's interesting when you look at China, it's not an overly dangerous place to be from the threat of, you know, gun violence, but it's dangerous for a lot of other reasons. And the idea that the government is going to just disarm the populace without us, you know, fighting for this issue in the courtroom, as well as individuals fighting for it in legislatures and fighting for it in bills is laughable. So yeah. Despite their goal, stated or unstated at this time, we'll certainly keep up the fight. And that's why we founded the Center to Keep and Bear Arms. And that's why we do what we do.
Yeah. Okay. Well, unfortunately, we are up against the clock. Cody Wisniewski, I want to thank you so much for your time.
Of course. Thank you so much for having me on, Mark.
Every true patriot is willing to pick up a gun to defend their country. But if you're willing to do that, be willing to pick up the phone first. Call your legislatures. Give them a polite earful about what's important to you. Just imagine if every patriot did that. The left expects you not to be engaged. They are terrified when you are. Because as we say every week, the best information does you no good if you don't use it. Reagan, what do you think?
I do not believe in a fate that will fall on us no matter what we do. I do believe in a fate that will fall on us if we do nothing.
It's more than a show. It's self-defense. The I Spy Radio Show.